see on here if necessary. Okay, so I think we can start now. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, on the word of the Buddha class, we are now up to chapter 7, sort of, the right mindfulness. So, you've got it on right mindfulness as well. Very good. Because they say that if you practice mindfulness, your memory gets very strong. But it's not as strong as a computer's memory, so well done. You got it the right place. So, here is the translation, Seventh Factor of the Eightfold Path. So, as usual, I will just go through a little bit and then we'll address any questions. What now is right mindfulness, the four focuses of mindfulness, and you see straight away it is changing it from the four foundations of mindfulness, you know, what they actually stand on, to actually to how mindfulness is directed, where it's actually to go to be able to find some interesting insights. So instead of foundations, I always call it like the focuses, where you should put your mindfulness on. So the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of the true way for the realization of Nibbana. Now you see also, as you come to this class over here, that instead of following these old translations, which are sometimes a bit, as they say in English, a bit dodgy, the first change you see there, which is following the translation of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, it's the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. And it is quite clear that it does not mean that it's the only way. I know that sometimes people say that the four focuses of mindfulness, Satipatthana, is the only way to enlightenment, but that is not consistent with the other teachings in the suttas, where the Buddha said the only way to enlightenment is Eightfold Path, yes. And that's that's in the Magga Pada in the Dhammapada. It's called Ezo wa Mago, this is the only way, Nati Anya, there's not another, Dasanasa Visuddhiya, for the purification of your insight. That's the Eightfold Path. So, but what it means, it's called Ekayana, and it's a one going. And that word Ekayana is used in another place, which is actually the very next sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it is referring to, this is where the Buddha was explaining the understanding of karma. There is some karma which you know is going to lead to a bad destination. There's another type of karma which leads to good rebirth. And so how can you know that? It's just like seeing a person walking in a path through the jungle which leads to a pit of burning coals. And there's no offshoot, no left turn, no right turn, it's just, it goes in that direction. He calls that ekayana, like a one going. And that's the only time that same word is used in different context in the Tripitaka. So what ekayana literally means is it goes in one direction, no U-turns, no sort of offshoots, it goes in a one direction only. So what Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is very, very accurate there. And it's a bit sort of mischievous if anyone says it's the only way, because that only way is referred to the Eightfold Path. So the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana. And we see over here why that means that it's leading one direction only. The first four focuses of mindfulness. Number one, having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful, Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware and of experience, Vedana, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind, Chitta, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. So there's a lot of repetition there, but this is the time I'm repeating that initial phrase. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of either the body, experience, mind or mind objects, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. And the where we say having restrained the five hindrances, the normal, usual, common translation is, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. That was the translation which was originated by Professor Rice Davids over 100 years ago. And of course, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world is a really bit strange translation. Grief for the world, you may have like grief for, say, your mother or your best friend, but grief for the world, you don't really use the word in that way. And covetousness for the world, again, covetousness is not a word which we often use these days. And that you will find, if you study the suttas in the original Pali, you will find those two words, loke abhijato manasang, and they are used in many other cases. Loke abhija is a synonym for the first hindrance. First hindrance, kamachanda, it usually is in Pali. The second hindrance is usually domanasa, but in this particular case, I don't know, the second hindrance is avipadya, but it's also domanasa in two suttas. So these are synonyms, they're actually used alternatively. So this is why that when the commentaries, which give you some indication of what is meant, when they say that those two words, Naloka Bija stands for the first of the five hindrances, and Domanasa stands for the second of the five hindrances, so this is actually what the commentaries and what usually is meant by the having restrained the five hindrances. It's talking about the five hindrances, to restrain them, and it makes so much sense because if you have the five hindrances very, very strong, then you can't be mindful of very much at all. It is those five hindrances which actually cloud the mind, which stop the insight, the wisdom coming up. They weaken wisdom. So that's why it's consistent with the rest of the teachings of the Buddha in the Sutta. The first part very clearly means having restrained the five hindrances. That is what one's supposed to do first of all, and then you can have enough awareness of the four things here, the body, the experience, the mind and the mind objects. That comes after you've restrained the five hindrances. And how do you restrain the five hindrances? By all of the factors of the Eightfold Path which went before. You have like a right understanding, a right view. Now that gets you into the ballpark of what we're doing this for. And we also have the right motivation, where you're coming from, which is motivations, the three motivations of letting go, renunciation, kindness and gentleness. Those are the three motivations. So you're already, you're actually letting go, renouncing, being kind, being gentle, where you're coming from. That's Samasankhapa. If you always have a look at that later on, it's in the same document here, the word of the Buddha. So once you're coming from the right place, as Ajahn Chah always used to remind us, we meditate to let go, to abandon, to renounce, not to get more things. So it is by renouncing, that means, and being kind, being gentle, that's where you restrain, you weaken the five hindrances. And then, also from that, we have the right speech, action, and livelihood, that also weakens the hindrances as well. We're not sort of going to the pub, you know, we're not going to parties, you know, we're actually restraining just the hindrances of wanting and ill will. And, you know, being more calm, and the efforts there, or rather the motivations, which is the effect which precedes this one, that also calms everything down. So those first six factors of the Eightfold Path, they have the, one of the purposes of them is having to restrain the five hindrances to calm you down enough so that when you do start doing the Satipatthana, you know, you're not sort of, mind is not running all over the place. You know, you are clear, energized, you know exactly what this is supposed to be doing. So that means you've got the groundwork. It is just like preparing the earth, you know, before you plant the vegetables. So having restrained the five hindrances. And having restrained the five hindrances, if you look at any of the commentaries here, you see that's exactly what they say as well. Restrain the five hindrances. And you abide aware of these things. You can't really be aware if those five hindrances are strong. If you've got so much like lust or wanting, you know, your mindfulness is out there somewhere, the object of what you want. Or if you, you know, get angry and upset at somebody, again, you're not really being aware of what's happening to you when you get, you know, mad with rage or negativity. And of course, those also just weaken the mind's strength. You haven't got much energy because that drains the body. You know, negativity gives you a big boost of energy, but once that goes, you're really very weak in your mental energies. And so that's where one gets the sloth and torpor and the restlessness from. And so all of those things, especially those first four hindrances, you can see that that is what actually stops you being mindful. So you restrain the five hindrances first of all to get some mindfulness going. It's not overcoming those five hindrances. It's restraining them enough to be mindful, and after mindfulness, the stillness of samadhi. And the stillness of samadhi is what suppresses the five hindrances for many, many, many hours. So this is where we restrain the five hindrances first of all. Energize, knowing the purpose of what you are doing. And the purpose of what you are doing here is, again, going to be explained in a few moments, just so we know what these four things are. You know, the four focuses here is the body, is the experience itself, the mind and the mind objects, and especially like the body, to realize that that body, you know, has nothing to do with you. It is just a vehicle. So, you know, you don't have too much concern about this body. Look after it, care for it, just like you would a car. But, you know, you don't just go berserk or ballistic, you know, when somebody scratches your car. You know, it's just bodies being the body. You understand what the body is, its limitations. You don't get upset with the body. And also you don't, one body is enough. You don't go looking for another body to share. And the experience. This is a translation which, you know, I'm pretty much sticking to these days. Usually they call Vedana the quality of the experiences, the effective quality, whether it's happiness, sadness, or in between, pleasure, pain, or in between. And to me that is just like saying there's, you know, the different species of trees. But what we're talking about is like trees or plants. So I think I'm very on strong ground here to say the second focus of mindfulness is on experience. Now, your experience you're having right now, what you experience. And of course the mind, the citta, and that is the sixth of the senses. Just talking earlier with one of our devoted regular supporters, and Aristotle, I was quoting Aristotle, that he always used to call the mind the sixth sense. And that sixth sense he called was a common sense, because it was common to the other five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And so whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, then the mind can also pick up and know it. And it's also somehow or other got lost in Western civilization. It's always been there in the East, and this is one of the reasons it's called materialism now in philosophy. Just the five senses, the body stuff, and no recognition of sort of the mental world. So I always say that that's one of the reasons for the problems and difficulties which people have in the West, because over those centuries we've lost our mind, literally, and we've abandoned our common sense. That was a joke, by the way. So anyway, that's the mind and the mind objects. I'll come across that later on. So anyway, straight away, it's not what you might have read before, which is brilliant, because the whole point of having a class here is not to tell you what you already know. That will just make you fall asleep. It's to take it further. Any questions about that so far? Yes. The five hindrances. These are, it's this what distorts your perception and cognition. In other words, you see what you want to see, and you block out what you don't want to see. That's aversion and wanting. Those are the first two. So this is the nature of human beings. The classic story, which I come across again, is that when you fall in love, your partner is the most beautiful person in the whole world, and you wonder how lucky you are that she also loves you, and you can't see anything wrong in her at all, or him. Just the way she picks her nose is just so cute. But usually after one or two years, you think, what the heck did I do marrying that? And same person, and that person could be you. So what's going on there? Is because that's what sort of love does. It is an illusion. It is, you see what you want to see. And when you get out of love, especially when you get angry and go to divorce courts, then again, because you're angry, you see all the faults in the other person. So, you know, which is actually true? Which is whatever you wish to focus on. And it becomes just, there's these hindrances. You're not seeing what's really there. You're seeing what you want to see, or you're blocking off, you know, what you don't want to see. That's, you know, that sort of attachment type love. Not the other type of love, which is opening the door of your heart to someone, whatever they do, however they are. And so that is those likes and dislikes. Makes us only not see the truth, but see what we want to see. And then, of course, because of that, the poor old mind gets so tired, wanting stuff and opposing stuff. That's where it gets lost in torpor from. You know, the tiredness of the mind. Just to be able to sit still and let things be is, you know, very difficult for people. But that's one of the reasons why when you meditate, you let things be, you don't fight, you know, you don't want, you don't give up not wanting. You just restrain those five hindrances and you get very still and your energies come up again. You know, you're actually no sloth and torpor anymore. But you're bright. But it's not coming from the willpower, it's what creates restlessness. So, you know, these, when we make peace with things, make peace, be kind, be gentle, you find the five hindrances get suppressed. So you're not fighting the world, which means you get energized. You're no sloth and torpor, but not restless either. And you're seeing what's right there, rather than what you want to see. So this is actually where the five hindrances are. It's actually what suppresses wisdom. What stops you being still? And of course, the one I missed out, the doubt, skeptical doubt, that is because, you know, one doesn't know exactly where one is going, what one is doing. And sometimes it takes a little bit of trust or experience to understand that how to overcome that doubt. And how one overcomes that doubt, enough awareness, you know that this is moving in a good direction, you're getting more peaceful. It seems to be working. You're more peaceful, less tiredness, less restlessness, you're in the middle there somewhere. this beautiful clarity, energy, but which is still. So that's roughly the five hindrances in brief. But all we say here is that those are what stops you being still, what stops you being wise, the hindrances. So one has to sort of calm them down first of all, which to me that's the job of the earlier factors of the Eightfold Path, just to restrain them, and then one can be clear enough to actually to take it deeper and to understand, become still, and then become incredibly mindful, so one can see what was the problem in the first place. I don't know if that answers the question, sort of. Okay. Anyway, that's the translation there. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, Vedana, experience, mind, and mind objects. And that is standard in commentarial Buddhism. And it makes sense according as justified from the suttas. So how are you aware of the body? So there are many different exercises here. And the first one is mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati. You go to a quiet, secluded place, sit down comfortably, and give priority to establishing mindfulness. Then mindful, you breathe in, mindful, you breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you are aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you are aware that they are short. Then you learn to experience the hold of the breath as you breathe in and out. Then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Just as a skilled painter is aware whether they are making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too, when the in-breath is long, you are aware that it is long, dot, dot, dot. In this way, you are aware of your own body, or you are aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you abide aware of the nature of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments, and those four nutriments, you know, later on we're going to mention those, are fish and chips. Oh no, sorry, just that's material food. Cups of tea. That's only messing around, sorry. The four nutriments are physical food, and it's contact, sensory experience, and also consciousness and will. Those are the four sort of nutriments which keep, you know, your body going. And it's just, that is just very easy to understand, because if you don't have any physical food, you run out of that. Of course, you can't sustain this body. It's got no gas, no fuel keeping it going, physical fuel. And then also the no passa, no contact, no physical, no sensory experience, which is one of the reasons why if someone is in a coma, you know, just touch them, talk to them, contact them if you want them to actually to come out. That, because without that physical experience, that sensory experience, of course, you know, they just, there's nothing actually to keep them in this body. And also you have the will to live, which is, you know, quite sort of common. People've seen that. People, you know, in hospital, they are about to sort of pass away, and they seem to not really be dying at all until some relation comes. They keep themselves alive through will, and up to a point, obviously. And the last one is consciousness. When consciousness, stream of consciousness departs the body, then the body passes away. So this is, you're aware that this body is just caused, and once that cause is taken away, so does the body pass away. You're aware that what causes the rising of the body, you abide that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's causal nature of both arising and ceasing, or else mindfulness is just a body, impermanent, suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation, and you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. Now that's a little standard there. Especially with the mindfulness of breathing, you go to a quiet, secluded place, sit down comfortably. Now, first of all, yes, it is possible if you have some training to sit anywhere to watch the breath. But, you know, it's like if you start to learn how to drive a car, you know, it's much better to do that in secluded, quiet streets, you know, when you're not going to get people beeping their horns at you all the time and giving you two fingers or one finger in Australia. So in other words, you know, you go to a place where you can learn the basics of meditation, and then later on you can meditate anywhere. But first of all, you go to a quiet, secluded place, sit down comfortably. Now, there's many things here which I have translated, and of course those of you who have listened to this class before notice that I translate the phrases, not the words. The unit which you should always translate is a phrase, never a word. Because if you translate words, that's when you get the old saying of it rained cats and dogs. And that's a stupid translation, it just means it rained heavily. You never see cats and dogs coming from the sky in a thunderstorm. What it means is it's an idiom. So we always translate the idiom, get the meaning of, you know, the phrase. And so you sit down comfortably. It did say in those days you sit down cross-legged, keeping your back erect. However, for many people that will cause you intense pain, and also it will not cause you any ability to be able to watch the breath. In other words, that was just the idiom of learning how to sit down comfortably. Sometimes you need to sit in a chair, or need to, you know, sit with your back against the wall with many, many different cushions. Fine. The whole point there is so the body is comfortable. And you give priority to establishing mindfulness. And the usual translation, you establish mindfulness in front of you. And of course, that means that many people think you have to watch the tip of your nose. And of course, those of you who haven't seen this before, that if I focus on the tip of my nose and I will keep my eyelids open, if I try focusing on the tip of my nose, what would happen is my eyes would also go to the tip of the nose and I'd become cross-eyed. That's what actually happens to people if you peel their eyelids back when they're meditating or focusing on the tip of the nose. Automatically, their eyes go to what their mind is looking at, and so they get these tension headaches across their head, their forehead. And that's why many people would complain to me the first time I went to Malaysia of samadhi headache. And I thought, that's crazy, what are you doing? Because they're really focusing hard, you know, on the tip of their nose. That's not what it means. It means you give priority, put it number one on the list to get mindfulness really strong first of all. And then once you have the mindfulness strong, then you can breathe in and out and notice the breath. If you try doing this when a person's mindfulness is still weak, you find they can't watch the breath. They go off somewhere because you haven't established, grounded your mindfulness strong enough yet to be able to do something like watching the breath. So this is where we say that the first thing you do is quite a secluded place, sit down comfortably, give priority to creating mindfulness. And you know that I usually try to establish the mindfulness by present moment awareness and silence. The peaceometer, you know, comfortable, look at the peaceometer, get yourself calm, and then you become aware of the breath pretty easily. And comfortably too. So then you get mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware they are long. The in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. In other words, you don't worry about controlling the breath. You just know, is it long, is it short? And there's many different ways of fulfilling those two parts of the of Anapanasati. It is, you don't have to breathe in a long breath and a short breath. Sometimes you can count the breaths, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Breathing in, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, breathing out. Or you can just start breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. Or in Thai, breathe in, but, breathe out, to. The buddho, buddho, buddho. There's so many ways of doing that. But the whole point is you give yourself some extra little, I call it like a crutch, to be able to learn how to walk. It's a little extra thing, so you can become aware of your breathing to the point that you can learn to experience the hold of the breath as you breathe in and out. And then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. So this is the first four steps of Anapanasati. And I did change the simile. They said like a lathe operator knows when it have a long pull or a short pull on the lathe. And of course that lathe is always electronic, automatic these days. I did have the opportunity in 43 years ago when we built a lathe, the old type of lathe with a bamboo and string, and then it was short strokes, long strokes, but people don't use that anymore. But certainly you've all done some painting, you know, when it's a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, that's what it means. So too, when the in-breath is long, you're aware that it's long. When it's short, you know it's short. In this way, you're aware of your own body, or the nature, or you're aware that the bodies of others are the same as yours, so you abide. What's the breath got to do with the body? And later on, the Buddha said, now this is, we call that the body is just, the breath is part of the body. It's just one way of getting this body awareness. So when you understand that this is part of your body, the breathing, that comes up later on when we talk about Anapanasati, which comes later on in the word of the Buddha. You see the Buddha specifically said, I call the breath as part of the body. And so this is one of the reasons why this counts as the body awareness, the first of the Satipatthana. But the whole point of it is that you know, you're aware of bodies, what they are like, that you know they are not under your control, they are just come from nutriments, from causes, and they cease, and it's just a body, that's all. Impermanent, suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness of wisdom, essential for liberation. That is one way you are mindful of the body. Any comments on that? Questions? So one thing here is, in the Anapanasati Sutta, this is Satipatthana Sutta, Anapanasati Sutta, it actually, maybe actually, it's further down here, let's go off to that one. It's on page... here we go. On page 44, can you scroll down? You got that one? Imagine 118. Mindfulness of breathing completes the four focuses of mindfulness. There may be different pages on you, on your one, but it's summary of the Satipatthana, the end of the Satipatthana. It's only a couple of pages down. Nibbana to Anapanasati. Well, I'll just read it out anyway, or are you looking for it? Okay. And you go to the paragraph, mindfulness of breathing completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And how does mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated complete the four focuses of mindfulness? When the in-breath and out-breath are long, and you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, and you're aware that they are short. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. When you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. On those occasions, you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body, in the category bodies. That is why on that occasion, a meditator abides mindfulness of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. So this is actually where the Buddha is actually saying, that watching the breath is watching the body. So that's one of the first ways, and one of the most common ways of doing the first focus of mindfulness. And the second way, the four postures. Yeah. The four postures. You got that down there? Good. When walking, you are aware in the present that I am walking. When standing, sitting, lying down, you are aware in the present that I am lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness however your body is disposed. In this way, you are aware of your own body, you are aware that the bodies of others are the same as yours, you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments you have, or you abide aware the body will cease when the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's cause and nature of both arising and ceasing, or mindfulness, it is just the body established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is another way you are mindful of the body. So here the mindfulness, stressing the point it's in the present moment, you are just knowing what you are doing. So instead of actually going somewhere, you are being here. And that way that you have the opportunity for you to know how your body is disposed, how it's, you know, what posture it's in, and that gives you a way of being mindful of the body to the point that instead of looking for something else, going somewhere else, you can actually be here and understand how this body works. Basically, it's not yours. I don't know if any of you have sometimes been meditating and maybe your arm lifts up or you twist around and it's totally, it hasn't been done by you. Or if you've ever gone for long walks, and certainly happened to me even going for long walks, and even more so when you're doing walking meditation, after a while you get into a routine and you know you don't do the walking anymore. It's like you're sitting there or standing there or sorry, walking, and you're just the body's doing the walking, and you don't tell the body to move, you don't tell the leg to sort of walk, it just is doing it by itself. You're on autopilot. It is that phenomena which was used to be noticed by soldiers who used to march instead of going in trucks, that they could march all night. And some of those soldiers would be fast asleep, but they'll still be marching. Basically, after a while, just you get into this rut, and the legs keep on moving. And you're not actually giving them any orders anymore. They just keep carrying on. You're aware, you're not sort of sleepwalking, but it's half-half. It's, you're aware of what's going on, but you're not giving any orders. Just the body keeps on doing the walking. It's really cool when you have those experiences. It shows you that, you know, it's, you're not really in control. And of course, if any doctor knows there's so much of your body anyway, which is on automatic, you know, breathing, heartbeat, and so many other stuff which you don't really know about. And that just is, shows that it's just the body is just the body. It breathes by itself. And whatever posture you're in, it's just the body is pretty automatic. Comments? Okay. Full comprehension of the purpose. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things. In the original it said when wearing your robes and carrying your bowl. But this is supposed to apply to everybody, not just monks. And I've never seen many of you wearing robes, and you don't carry bowls. But whatever you're carrying things, it's make it sort of relevant to everybody. You act in full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Why are you doing this? In this way, you're aware of your own body, aware of the bodies of others and the same nature as yours, or you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. It's another way of like looking at the body and understanding it. Or else mindfulness is just a body, that's all. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. The bodily parts. You review your body from head to toe, bounded by skin, as made up of many kind of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs, just as though were a full shopping bag with many kind of groceries, such as bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. So too you review the same body as full of many parts thus. In this body there are hairs, bones, shit and urine. This is another way you're mindful of the body. You put a little bit of a gross word in there just to get people's attention, because sometimes people start falling asleep on a hot afternoon when they've heard this before. Okay, I apologize to people who are offended. But all it really means is don't go through every one of these one after another, because that was just the way in the time of the Buddha that they understood the, you know, what the body is composed of. And you may notice that in the original it says 31 parts of the body, but later on they realized they missed out the brain. So, you know, that's why in the commentaries they added the second part of the brain as number 32. The original was a no-brainer. Oh, come on. It's a hot afternoon. But what it means, it doesn't matter, 31, 32, 33 or whatever. But the point is, it's just little parts. So you just look at this body, what actually is it? It's just different kinds of stuff. And in the original, it had the different types of rice. Okay, and so hill rice, red rice, paddy rice, I don't know what else other rice there was. But, you know, here you say shopping bag with different types of groceries, which is what I'm trying to do here, is like keep the essence of the simile but make it a little bit more understandable. Or elements, you reveal your body by way of elements, thus in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element. This is another way you are mindful of the body. And of course I resisted that as a physicist before, because two of those especially, the fire element and the air element, a fire was heat and air was vibration, they were both the same. But it's just one way of just splitting up this thing which we call stuff into different elements. But, you know, just when you split them up into its parts, you realize that's nothing much there. Or the nine charnel ground contemplations. And it's amazing just sometimes how people really get into this stuff. You see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, up to 3 days old, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. Then you reflect your own body is the same nature. It may become like that. It's not exempt from that fate. You know, sometimes it's amazing. Some monks, you know, need to go and see a psychologist sometimes, because they start to say, oh, you see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, being devoured by birds, animals, or matters. You don't do that. It's just seeing the nature of a body. Then you reflect your own body is the same nature. It may become like that. It's not exempt from that fate. You see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh, blood held together with sinews. Flesh with skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews. A skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Bones bleached white, the color of shells. Bones heaped up. Bones more than a year old, rotten and crumbled to dust. You reflect that your own body is of the same nature, may become like that, is not exempt from that fate. And I think you're getting the message here, which I hope the purpose of this is just so you can see it's just a body, that's all. Nothing to really get too attached to. And it's really quite surprising that sometimes when people see a dead body, actually it's very hard to see a dead body. If there's ever an accident, straight away someone throws a white cloth over it on the side of the road. If it's a road accident or any other sort of a tragedy where people get killed. And sometimes, you know, we're not allowed to see dead bodies. And even it's a great privilege sometimes to be able to, you know, have the opportunity to actually to see and touch something which is dead. Especially a body. I remember many times in the funerals which I went to over in Thailand, you know, with no sort of formaldehyde, no sort of makings of the body look really nice. It was just really down to earth. And for some visitors, it's the first time they've ever seen a body or touched it or felt it, what it's like to have a dead body. And actually, it takes away a lot of the attachments to a body. Even better that we did have the opportunities even early here in Perth of going to the mortuary. You know, the coroner at that time was a neighbour of Dennis Shepherd, so we had permission to go in there and actually, you know, see an autopsy. And it was just a wonderful thing to be able to see. That's just my body, your body, we're all the same. You can't say it's beautiful or it's attractive or it's ugly, it's just a body, that's all. It's wonderful to be able to see that. And what that means is it takes away the attachment to a body. It's just a body, that's all. Yeah. Ah, okay. You have to have the attachment in order to be alive. It's differentiating caring from like owning. So you have a car. You're going to have to let that go sometimes. You're going to have to. It's going to get so old sooner or later. You have to. It won't pass any tests. It's not roadworthy anymore, and you get rid of it. But you don't keep going for too long. You care for it, but you don't own it too much. So the difference between care and owning. Like the owning of a body and identifying with a body is just when people get Botox and those jobs. When you see people used to be really, really beautiful and fit, trying to fake it. All these old film stars, were attractive in their youth and there was so much makeup that it's quite sad. There's nothing wrong with being old. If you can allow that to happen, you don't have to keep dyeing your hair. I don't. So, all you're saying is just you understand what this body really is and you don't try and expect from it what it will never be able to give you. So you care for it, but you don't obsess about it. You don't own it. So when it's ready to be replaced, then you let it go. You don't keep clinging on to life, when it's your partial use by date. So anyway, it's just a body. It's impermanent. And this way you're aware of your own body. You're aware the bodies of others are the same as yours. You abide aware of both your own and others' bodies. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, just these nutriments to keep a body going. What really causes it to continue, again, is your food. Is also the experience. That's why sometimes when people just get very old and they stay in their beds, they don't get up, they don't have any contact, they don't have any stimulation. You can see it's like a slow death. They don't have like this contact, this experience, to stimulate them. And that's why sometimes you can see that people who do work with people with Alzheimer's or dementia, something which stimulates them, just like a dance or old music. People really get sort of lively and that sort of stimulates them. They get some contact which gets them alive. And also the will as well, the will to live, which is really important. And also when there's consciousness there, the consciousness leaves and they're gone. And so you understand the what causes the body. You're by contemplating what causes the arising of the body, you're by where the body's the nature to cease, where the four nutriments cease, you're by contemplating the body's cause or nature, both arising and ceasing. Well, why, if it's just a body, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness or wisdom, essential for liberation. So you can let it go, but you still care for it. Care for it, but be able to understand that one day it's going to go. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. It's one way you are mindful of the body. There's some benefits. When mindfulness of the body has been repeatedly practiced and developed, these benefits can be expected. You overcome delight and discontent. Because this delight and discontent, mostly about bodily stuff, just how beautiful you are, how thin you are, or discontent that you're too fat, or in other words, much of the stuff which people just worry about is body stuff. You overcome fear and dread. You can bear cold, heat, hunger and thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, creeping things. You enjoy unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful and menacing to life. Because it's your body, it's not you. It's this body doing its stuff. Now, what is really, I guess, interesting, you experience whenever needed, without difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind to provide a pleasant abiding in this very life. And the reason for that is because the jhanas happen when you can let go of the body and its five senses. The jhana is just, you know, when the body is just not important to you anymore, you can let it go. And I often focus on this point, that one of the reasons why people can get pretty still, but they can't get fully still enough to let the body go, because they're afraid of letting the body go. They are attached to the body. Because to be able to let the body go, the five senses which protect the body, you know, the hearing. If I don't keep my hearing intact, somebody's going to creep up on me, and who knows what they're going to do with my body. If my physical feelings are disappearing, like that Singaporean man years ago, he said, I can't meditate anymore. My hands were disappearing. See, that's only the start of it, mate. More things are going to disappear. And it's great to have all these things disappear. But why can't we let it go? When the process is happening, why do we interfere and stop with it? It's the fear. And fear is always losing something which we're attached to, which we haven't seen before. In this particular case, we're attached to our body. We just won't let it go. So little by little, when you do the body awareness, you know, it's just a body, that's all, so you can actually let it disappear. And that's when your attachment to the body, which disappeared, at least, you know, it's gone for a little while, that is when the jhanas become easy. And because of the jhanas, the people really get into this sort of stuff. And then you can wield the various kind of supernormal power. Interested? Having been one, you can become many. Having been many, you can become one. You appear and vanish. You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain, as through space. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it were the earth. Sitting cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. You wield bodily mastery as far as even the Brahma world, the God world. Why is it only as far as the Brahma world? Because that's the limit of the five sense world. That's Rupa, that's Kamaloka. Beyond then is the jhana worlds. With clear audience, a divine ear, you can hear sounds both heavenly and human that are far as what is near. You can read the minds of other persons, having compassed them with your own mind, especially whether the mind is affected by one of the five hindrances or whether it's experiencing a jhana. You can recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births and many eons of expanding universes and decaying universes. There I was so named, as such a family, such appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there I appeared in this other place. And there too, I was so named, of such a family, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, you recollect many of your past lives. With the clairvoyance and divine eye, you see beings pass away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their actions, their karma. And most important benefit number 10, by realizing for yourself with direct experience in this very life, you enter upon the bond, the deliverance of mind, the deliverance by wisdom, you are an enlightened one. So that's, by the Buddha, the benefits of the mindfulness of the body, basically, so you can let go of concern of the body and just put your energy focus on the importance of the mind. And that means that you get jhanas and you get supernormal powers. Interested? Why? Because when people say, well, have you ever seen psychic powers? Of course, you know, as a monk. But there's a problem there. Because just like even Devadatta, you know, got some psychic powers and thought he was the equivalent of a Buddha. You saw something very similar in my first year as a monk in Thailand, where there was one monk who, you know, stated he could hear, you know, conversations which were happening about 6 miles away. And they checked him out. It was true. You know, he had this amazing, this clear audience. And as a result of that, that, you know, one day he thought, you know, he was as good as Ajahn Chah and sat in Ajahn Chah's chair, you know, in Wat Pa Phong. And, you know, Ajahn Chah was really skillful, just, you know, come over here. And the next day he bowed to every monk, you know, in the monastery, and then he departed, never saw him again. Don't know where he went to. But, you know, realized that his attainment, like Devadatta's, had caused him to get a bit too proud of what is his attainment. But those things sometimes do happen, you know, the reading minds and stuff. But, as I tell people, that, you know, if you read one person's mind, you know, you don't need to be afraid, because people's minds are not interesting enough to read. You know, it's just like reading a sort of a pulp fiction, a trash novel. Now, honestly, you know, is your mind ready to be read? So anyone who can do that, just do it once or twice for fun, never do it again. Waste of time. Yes, go on.
Before we go too far, I just want to go back to the hindrances. When we have doubt, what's the difference between, this is the part I'm not quite sure, that sort of doubt and the doubt the person entering into the stream winner of doubt overcomes? Well, what's the difference in the doubt business?
The difference in those, in the, you know, the doubt of, right, which is overcome with a stream winner, you know, is, you know, on the teachings of the Buddha, especially the core teachings, you know, of there's nothing in here, you know, like of no me, no mine, not a self. So these things which we take to be me, the body, you know, the first of the khandhas, and just the experience, you know, the second of the five khandhas, the five components of existence, and, you know, the will, you know, and this, the mind. All of these things, there's nothing to do with me. There's nothing, no essential essence in there. So if you've seen that for yourself, then, you know, there's no doubt anymore. But to be able to see that for yourself is seeing something which, you know, will always, again, shock you to the core, turn you over. It's not what you expect. Doesn't matter how many times, you know, people teach about non-self, you know, that there's no one in here, that, you know, that you didn't desire to ask that question. You know, it was already sort of conditioned. You always assume that you're in control of your body and your speech and your mind and stuff like that. And actually, when you start to talk about even like the consciousness is just a process, it's not a being inside there, you know, which is like a person on the computer screen, on the mouse, kicking this and clicking that, deciding what to do. When you find out the driverless bus, there's no actually driver in that bus. All of those things, you know, actually shock you. It's not what you expect. So, you know, that is where your doubts are overcome, when those experiences happen to you and you realize, my goodness, you know, what the Buddha was saying here, you know, is something I've seen for myself. So that's where the doubt disappears, and it's replaced by confidence. This Buddha knows exactly what he's talking about. Even actually yesterday somebody was asking about the going for refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. They can understand a bit about the Dhamma and the Sangha, but about the Buddha. You know, how can you actually have real confidence in the Buddha, real refuge in the Buddha? And, you know, the answer is that when you've seen the Dhamma and the Sangha, you know, the purpose of it, and, you know, what it really means when you become a stream winner, that's where your confidence becomes solid. That's where you can go to refuge in the Buddha. You know what you're taking refuge really in. The one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. You understand what that really means. So that's actually, you know, where the doubt disappears, the stream winning. This over here is restraining the doubt. suppressing it for a little while, so it gives you the opportunity to be still enough to actually to overcome the doubt once and for all. Make sense?
So if you're quite aware at the time of death, then after death, that's why you could become a stream winner, because you could see the body, it's gone, nothing to do with me. Is that right?
Exactly, that's a powerful point. That sometimes people think, oh, you know, I want to be a stream winner, but they find it hard to let go. But you know, when you're dying and the death process, you know, things are taken away from you. You know, whether you like it or not. You know, this body is seen, it doesn't belong to you. And that's an obvious thing. And also that at that time, you know, you have an opportunity to totally, or at least let go enough to become the stream winner. It's not me, not mine, not a self in this body. It's not me, not mine, not a self. The experience is always changing. So much you can actually see, even this jitter, this mind. You know, you can see that just comes and goes as well. So the death moment is a very important part. Possible part, if you have not seen the Dharma before, now you can very easily see it. If you've just got the background, the basis, you know, to letting go. Now, one of the things which most people actually say that in the dying process, that when you are past the point of no return and you've left the body, it's just so peaceful, so free, so wonderful. Why is it so peaceful? Because a lot of suffering has disappeared. The suffering of having a body, of having five senses, is gone. So that, you know, if one can look at it in the right way, you've had some teachings before which can point you in the right direction, then you've got a chance of seeing these things which I thought belonged to me and which were pleasurable, they've now disappeared. Oh, how wonderful that is. Okay. Okay, now there's a little part here. Arising and passing away, rise and fall. Sometimes people ask the questions about rise and fall. What does it really mean? Because you see here in each one of these satipatthana, you are, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body. You abide aware the body is a nature to cease, or you abide contemplating the bodies arising and ceasing. And what does that actually really mean? And this is where we quote from the Satipatthana Samyutta. What does it mean by the arising and passing away, the rise and fall? I will teach you the origination and the passing away of the four focuses of mindfulness. Supported by the four nutriments, there is the origination and continuance of the body. And with the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. And the four nutriments are food, the six sense contacts, nipassa, will and consciousness. Supported by the six sense contacts, there is the origination of experience, the vedana. With the cessation of the six sense contacts, experience ceases. So this is the second satipatthana. Supported by nama rupa, which in brief means the objects of consciousness, there's the origination of the citta. With the cessation of nama rupa, the citta ceases. Supported by attention, there's the origination of mind objects. With the cessation of attention, the mind objects cease. So what we're saying here, that each one of these, it's not just seeing them rise and fall, it's actually seeing them come into existence and pass away totally. It's not just seeing, say, the third satipatthana, the citta, the mind, just, you know, come and change. It's actually seeing the whole thing disappear. And the simile which I often use, it's not just seeing the programs on the TV change. It's seeing the whole TV set vanish, which, you know, is very confronting. It's not supposed to happen like that. He's watching the TV and the whole thing, the whole set vanishes. This is what we call like ceasing, rising and passing away. Seeing things come and go, that's obvious. But seeing things arise and then cease totally, and that is weird. So this is with each one of these things. That's what it means by rise and fall. They have a cause, and when the cause is taken away, it vanishes. And that goes with experience, goes with the mind, goes with the mind objects. And that's where you can tie that in with the other great suttas, such as the Aggiwatagota Sutta, where the Buddha, you know, compared this citta like a flame. It's actually what he really said in there was a fire. And the fire is dependent upon the fuel. When the fuel is burnt out, the fire disappears. And that's when he said, but where does it go to? Does it go to the north, east, south, west, up or down? It doesn't go anywhere, it just vanishes, that's all. And that's where, you know, I just use that same simile, and with good ground, because this is also part of the enlightenment experience of Patachara. And she, again, was looking at a flame, a candle flame, actually an oil lamp flame, and a gust of wind blew the flame out. And what was the flame there anyway? It was just three causes. The flame depended upon the oil, the wick, and the heat. And when one of those was removed, in this particular case the heat, because the wind blew the heat away, then the flame stopped, disappeared, vanished. And the word for that, as you should all know by now if you've been paying attention, the word for it ceasing is nibbanat. That's the way they used to say, when a flame stops, it nibbanat. So this is actually where you can see that when we see the causal factor of this body, and it's just a process, it's not a thing which has, you know, a permanent essence. Experience is not a thing. It comes and goes. You see its causes, when the causes are taken away, the experience stops. And when the mind has its causes, the objects of consciousness, when they stop, the mind stops. And also the mind objects. When the cause stops, they stopped. So this is why we have the cause and effect. Notice the causes, and you see there's nothing really there, just like a flame. That's why you can always say that somehow, I don't know how he managed to do this, Elton John must have had some knowledge of the Dhamma when he wrote Flame in the Wind. I've never heard that, but apparently he's a flame in the wind. It's supposed to be a good song. A candle in the wind. Shows you how, you know, I'm actually being honest here. I haven't heard that. A candle in the wind. Okay. So you must have got that from the Buddhist text. Do you reckon? I don't know. Sorry? He might. Anyway, here we go. Mindfulness of experience. How are you mindful of experience, Vedana? With a pleasant experience, you're mindful you feel a pleasant experience. When feeling an unpleasant experience, you're mindful you feel an unpleasant experience. When feeling a neutral experience, you're mindful you feel a neutral experience. When feeling a worldly pleasant experience, a worldly unpleasant, or a worldly neutral experience, you're mindful that you feel such a worldly pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience. When feeling an unworldly pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience, you are mindful you feel such an unworldly pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience. In that way, you're aware of your own experience, Vedana. Are you aware that the experience of others is of the same nature of yours? Or you abide mindful of both your own and others' experience? Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of experience? Sensory contact. We abide aware that experience is the nature to cease. When a sensory contact ceases, you abide contemplating experience's causal nature, both arising and ceasing. Or else mindfulness, that is just experience, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential to liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. not clinging to experience, not expecting what experience will never give you. That is how a meditator abides mindful of experience. And the difference between a worldly and an unworldly experience, Vedana, you have the worldly pleasurable experiences. Those are things which are not going to be conducive actually to freedom and liberation, but the unworldly pleasant experiences are, such as inspiration. When you hear a really good Dhamma talk, when you see that there is a possibility for freedom, when you can see there's an ending of things, not continuing. This is especially the joys of meditation, the joys of letting go. It's unworldly because it's lessening your attachment and an entanglement in this world. This is why we call it an unworldly pleasant experience. What about an unworldly unpleasant experience? What would that be? Oh, you know this question. Okay, go on.
It could be the ending of the jhana.
The ending of the jhanas? An unworldly, unpleasant experience. You reckon? I think it's understanding that this is the nature of dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. So you understand as well what's happened to you. That you're stuck in this prison. At least you have some wisdom what's going on. But it's not something which is going to keep you in there forever. It's almost like a nibbida experience, where you see there's a problem. Yes, you're being honest, there's a problem, but you see that problem is going to lead to a way out. It's a suffering which leads to the end of suffering. But anyway, it's just experiences all. And especially the reason why you have the pleasant, unpleasant, and in between experiences is to know that that is the nature of everybody's life, and unfortunately you can't do much about it. Just talking to someone I think yesterday, it's a very old experiment which is done when people say you finish your work and you've on holiday or you retire, you get a spike in happiness, but then you come back down again. You have a great sickness, you know, you've overcome cancer. Yay! And you get so much happiness, but then you come down to the median level again. So in other words, people think you win the lottery. Well, yeah, I don't need to go to work anymore. But then, you know, it comes down again. So you have these spikes in happiness. But then it always comes down to the old median level again. It's not really sustainable. So you cannot have sort of the idea of permanent happiness. Sometimes it's not just sensory experience, but it's also understanding that that sensory experience has to change to be noticed. So you can't have a heaven where everything is happy ever after. If it's happy ever after, then you wouldn't notice it anymore. That's why it was Saint Augustine who said that you have to have at least one day every year in Christian heaven when you go down to hell. Otherwise you wouldn't experience what heaven was. Or just like during a range retreat when somebody was getting bored, so this is a lay meditator at Jhana Grove, and he said, "Oh, I'm really getting bored, meditation's not working." I sent him to Armadale Shopping Centre to get something for me, and then he realised what a heaven Jhana Grove was. So it is the old thing that, you know, the extent of the happiness is actually dependent upon the suffering which went before. And the suffering is about the happiness you've lost. It's measured by what went before or what comes afterwards. Yeah, so
not sure what I'm trying to get across, but it's like when you pass over and the body's gone. All right. There is the essence within you.
Ah.
And, or whatever you want to call it. Okay. So I guess it would be part of the essence's belief systems as to where you either A might go or how you were feeling at the time when you pass over, so that you disconnect from a lot. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes, but...
Go on then.
No, it's just that we take with us, you know, when we die, we go through that process, you know, a lot of our perceptions, ideas. And that is why what fascinated me with accounts of people who have past life experiences, that, you know, how they react, you know, to the fact they're, you know, they're different than what happened before, that, you know, they have no physical pain, that they feel a lot of free. That joy which they have, that ease, that peace which they have, is the result of all that pain and suffering which they had before. You know, as an old person, sick person, a person who has been traumatized by some accident, it's like a whole burden of pain and problems just vanishing. But that's a spike of happiness. Then what happens next is really important. That many people, they go off to the light. And you see what people come back and what they say. They come back and they say, well, that was Jesus, that was pure love, if they were like a Christian. If they were a Catholic, they come back, it's Virgin Mary, she welcomed me, and it was true. If they are sort of a Mahayana Buddhist, it was the goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin, and they actually absolutely say they saw it, exactly. If they saw any angels, if they are Thai, they see the angels with the funny hats on. You know, it really depends on your culture, what you see. And interestingly, atheists who don't believe in sort of a religion per se, they come back and say they saw Uncle George. In other words, and sometimes you listen to these accounts, what's actually going on there? And yeah, this is actually that, yeah, you know, you see something there, but it's how we colour it in. It's how we perceive it. The perception is how we make what we expect to happen. If you've been, say, a Thai or say a Cambodian, you've been in those temples and you've seen all of that since you were a kid, and if that's what you expect heavenly beings to look like, that's how you will perceive them. You know, if you're like a Westerner in the old days, you know, they all wear white clothes with a donut on top and just, you know, the little ring and have wings, that's how you will see them. It's amazing just how we see what we expect to see, and especially when we go to those states of that they literally are called mind-made states, anumayakaya. So there we can actually just to see just the way that we perceive is a lot to do with our conditioning, how we've expected to perceive. And if you follow a path which has a lot of fear and guilt, that's what you'll carry with you. Fear and guilt about things which you've done in the past. No one has been absolutely perfect, which is why a lot of times people are terrified of death. I always say that, imagine, you know, have you ever gone to an examination, you're really afraid whether you're going to pass or you're going to fail? Could be like a, you know, a test, or it can be like a driving exam, or it can be like an English test. You know, if you do the for the permanent residents. Are you afraid of that? That's not so bad, because you can always do it again. But you know, the idea that you have one chance and that's it, heaven forever or hell forever, then that would just, you know, make anybody pretty sort of anxious, because no one is that perfect. They have no fear of judgment. Judgment day is coming. Whatever. That's just so much fearful. But the idea of being able to let go, forgive, not carry around the past, not punish yourself for mistakes, but learn from mistakes. That type of freedom of forgiveness, and always having a second chance, a third chance, many chances, that allows you to die much more peacefully, with far more anxiety, knowing that you can always do the test again. So things like that, it's just what we put into the dying process, and a lot of that is our conditioning. No, just our belief systems. So that's one of the reasons why the dying process, what's going to happen next, very much depends on just what you've been doing for your life and the conditioning which you've had, the amount of ability to let go. Make any sense?
Yeah.
It's also the fact that I often say that the meditation is a way of just practicing how to die, learning how to let go. Because when you're meditating, you can't take your friends with you into meditation, you can't take your loved ones. If you start thinking about what your loved one is up to, then you get sort of restless and you get distracted. So it's a way of just learning how to let go of the past and the future and all the other things you have to do in life, your family, your reputation. Whatever happens, you just let that all go when you're meditating. And also you learn how to let go of the body. You're learning how to die. Practice. And if you do it well, then the body vanishes. Then you get into a nice mind state, understand what that is like, and then come back again. And when it really happens, when you do have to leave the body behind, you know how to do it really well.
So the essence still is alive in some point in time.
Ah, the essence, that's something else. The essence is definitely not your body, and it's not experience, because that comes and goes. So to find out what the actual essence is, what people take to be the essence, the chitta, the mind, that comes in the next episode of The Word of the Buddha. Very good. Oh, any other? Oh, we've got comments from overseas. Okay, better do this one before we finish off. Here we go. Okay, from Sri Lanka, from Canada, and from the other side of the world. In Majjhima Nikaya number 10, that's the Satipatthana, do you abide being aware of the body, experience it? Do you initiate it, or does it happen without your effort at the time? I think by the body experience, I think maybe referring to the third of the Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath, because there it says you're aware of the whole body of breath. Is sabbakaya pati sangvedi. And sabbakaya pati sangvedi, being aware of the body experience, I think that sometimes people say that means being aware of the physical body as a third part of anapanasati. So anapanasati, it's a long, breathing in, long breath, breathing out, long breath. Short breath, being aware of the whole body of the breath. It, to me, that is always a misinterpretation of the meaning of that term. Body means kaya. The Buddha says the breath is the kaya, is the body here. So I think here you are meaning you are aware of the whole breath, the whole accumulation of breath, which is from the beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath, the beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath. So instead of just being aware of long, short, long, short, the breath becomes more full, the whole of the breath. So from the beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath, the beginning of an out-breath to the end of an out-breath, noticing the spaces in between, sort of like full awareness, the whole of the breath. I think that's what you mean there. Do you initiate it? Not really, because this is just what happens as you become more and more calm, more and more still, that what happens is that you just become more peaceful and you can see more. You can actually see the whole body of the breath from beginning to end. It's just what happens quite naturally. It's just like I was saying last night? Yes. The story of walking up Kingsbury Drive, that when you went slower and slower and slower, you got out of the car, you started walking, you stopped walking, and you actually stood still. When you stood still, you saw so much more of what was in that hillside. You saw the details of it, and it looked very beautiful. The same way when you're doing breath meditation, as you go slower, you naturally see more of it. You know, just try walking down the street, you know, where you have your house or apartment. Walk more slowly, and then you see so much more. And actually stop and just stare. And it's amazing when you just take the time to stop and stare. Again, you see so much more which you haven't seen before. As you go slower and slower and slower, this is where you see more of the body. So being aware of the whole of the breath is actually where you don't initiate it. It just happens when you start to stop. Not when you start to stop, when you stop starting. I hope that's what you mean. Okay. From Canada, it's not from Canada, because she typed in her name, it's a venerable. In order for the knowledge of suffering or nibbita to be unworldly, unpleasant experience, to what extent does one need to remain inclined to release? In other words, the unworldly suffering, it's unworldly suffering if it leads to, detaching from stuff, from letting go of stuff. Somebody was asking me earlier about, the people who want to become enlightened, want to stop suffering, the desire, the craving to end existence. It's called vibhavadanha. What's that difference between the aspiration to become enlightened? And if it's a wanting, if it creates more wanting, more craving, that is the stuff which keeps things going. Already, just I mentioned, the will keeps the body going. And later on we'll find out that will, that wanting, also causes the consciousness to keep on going, the mind to keep on going. This is where the Buddha said in the dependent origination, it's the sankharas keep going, the vijnana, the consciousnesses. So it's the willing that creates the consciousness. It doesn't stop it. So thinking that you can will yourself to nirvana, it doesn't actually happen. It's vibhavadanha. Well, the Buddha said the dog chasing its own tail. What I use is the trying to eat your own head. Sounds possible, but it's impossible. So trying to want to stop wanting obviously doesn't work. So the unworldly experience, if it causes you to want something, then of course it will just lead to more experience. So if it leads, the negative experience leads you to abandon wanting, it's a part of the path, then it's going to be unworldly. It's going to lead out of the world rather than more existence. So that's where knowledge of suffering, if it's the knowledge of the cause of suffering, we have nibbida towards wanting. This is nibbida, is like, just what am I doing this for? All this wanting stuff, controlling, just gets me into trouble. So when you see that it's the wanting we have, if you want to look at it this way, it's so hard to get out of the word wanting, that wanting is a problem, so learn how to calm down to stop the wanting. You can't want to want. You can't want to let go of wanting. So how we do it is we just let go. Let go is the opposite of wanting. Wanting to let go, of course, is not letting go. I want to let go. Come on. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. So we have let go of wanting. So that is where the suffering, if the suffering causes the understanding to let go of wanting, then it works. Any comments, questions here? Great. Okay, you got one. Okay. Oh, how are you? Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry I'm new to this, but I always enjoy your talks and your meditation. I have a question and two questions really. Do you recognise Christmas? I noticed on Friday you had all the Christmas decorations up.
Yes, indeed. We call it Buddhamas. Yes, we do. A celebration. In other words, that I did mention on Friday night that Ajahn Chah used to say, well, what is Christmas anyway? You know, we celebrate sort of giving, sharing, being kind to all beings. Can't see anything wrong with that.
No, well, the one thing I've learned about Buddhism is that you seem to respect everyone and everything in this world, so that's wonderful. The other question was, have you read the book On Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it's true to a certain extent. But, you know, it's like one size fits all. There's great research, but not everyone has the rejection, burying your head in the sand, it's not going to happen to me. Don't always have the anger. Some communities, they see death, they've understood it already, and they don't have grief. This was an experience, personal experience in northeast Thailand, which was an indigenous culture, and no Westerners had ever actually gone into that place and colonized it. And it was very Buddhist culture, and for, I think, 9 years I was there, never saw anybody crying at a death, at a funeral ceremony. It was a village. They were right next door. I used to go to there every day for alms round. They would come to see us. We were part of things. He never saw grief.
So it was a celebration of life when someone died.
It was an acceptance of life.
Hmm.
That life, you know, will have death, and there's no fear about it.
Wonderful.
It was accepted. So the idea that you have to have those stages, you know, before you get through things, is a wonderful little piece of research. But, you know, sometimes it's exceptions.
Cultural.
To see you don't have to have grief.
So you're saying cultural?
Cultural, yeah.
Mm, excellent. Thank you.
It's grief is what our culture adds on to loss. And you see this, you know, when somebody like a Princess Diana dies, it goes totally berserk. You know, not saying you disrespect, you know, her, but it went so amazingly. Just people didn't even know her. And they were crying and just they're so sad and depressed. What's going on? Anyway, so that's, you see, what people add on to loss is grief. It's actually not necessary. Anyway, now is the time to let you go. I'll let Eddie go.
It's okay.
Hold the microphone. Yes, come on.
Oh. Ajahn Brahm, just now you mentioned about one thing, you know.
One thing, yeah.
Yeah, and letting go of one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I take one thing as desire, same as desire.
Desire, craving, yes.
Yeah, yeah. The Buddha did say, he says, having desire is suffering. Not achieving what we desire is also suffering.